we're going to continue then this exploration of some of the ideas and the methods behind parameter estimation and goodness of fit. So I'm minded that in section three, what we did was we started off talking about least squares probably in a very familiar form, just y equals a plus bx, what you will have met before. And then before you knew it, you were talking about matrix equations and singular value decomposition and all sorts. Where you will wind up on that spectrum in terms of your own research will depend on the field. I mean, there's probably folks out there, I'm sure if I ask, might as well ask the question, is there anyone who's, you know, had to learn a bit about things like singular value decomposition already? Yeah, well, you know, a couple of hands, but not many. How many people have done a least squares fit, we asked before, and it was a much, much higher number. So some of the flavours of least squares that I went through there are much more kind of specialised. They're for situations where the simple version won't work and you've got to do something cleverer. But maybe the key point to stress, like I was saying at the very beginning, is that you're no longer really in a situation where there will always be someone to tell you which method you should use. There'll certainly be people to offer advice and help, but sometimes those kind of choices are very firmly down to you. It's not like when you were an undergraduate, where, as I said, there's an answer at the back of the book, and you can sort of deduce from that answer what you were supposed to do. Instead, sometimes you might be the people who are getting that answer for the first time. So the key thing isn't so much to fill your head full of lots of facts about how to do this or how to do that. It's just to accept that you're now at a stage where you've got to sort of keep your wits about you. You've got to think about what might be going wrong with a piece of code or data analysis code that either you're using or someone else has used, and therefore to know where to go and look to think of how to do it better. You know, you're not going to get a PhD necessarily for developing a new bit of statistics. The chances are the statisticians have done it already. But what you can get your PhD for is being cunning enough to go and look in the right bit of the statistics literature and use some technique that will make your results a lot better than anyone else's have been. Okay, so I'd like to press on with section four then, and that will nudge us a bit more towards a Bayesian treatment. For example, the book by Sivia, which is one of the main two that I've drawn this material from, in chapter three, Sivia approaches least squares a little bit differently. I mean, it's still the basic same story, that what you're doing is minimising the sum of the squares of the residuals. But Sivia points out that you don't always know what sigma is. So we were assuming in all of the formulae we used in section three, when sigma was appearing on the, you know, denominator of all of those formulae, that we knew what sigma was. Well, sometimes you don't. So you've got to be able to do least squares even in the case where you don't know what sigma is. And Sivia provides, I think, a very neat way to lead you into that, because he basically says, well, if we know what sigma is, it's all dead easy. You can do things in terms of normal residuals, and the formulae look just like they would in the frequentist approach. But if you don't know what sigma is, what you basically should do is marginalize over different possible values of sigma. And what that does is it turns the normal distributions that applied in the previous section into a different sort of distribution called the student's t distribution. Now again, you might not have met that before, you might never meet it, it's again quite a specialised situation, but there are many situations in physics where you either don't know what the errors are, or you maybe are a bit wary as to how big the errors are, and therefore sometimes it's worth doing the analysis this way, where sigma is marginalised over, just to see if it makes any difference. Because if the significance of your result is resting on you knowing what sigma is, and you've got sigma wrong, then that could really change the outcome of your experiment. So I can recommend looking at Sivia if you want to find out a bit more about student's T. And we'll come back a bit more to student's T in just a few minutes in a different context. But I'd like to move on to talking about the principle of maximum likelihood now, and to try to demonstrate A, how useful it is, but also how similar to least squares in certain circumstances it is. So even if you've not heard of this before, you might well have been using it without knowing. So in the frequentist approach, like we discussed before, lunch, a parameter is a fixed but unknown constant, and the job of data analysis is to estimate what that parameter is. So from the actual data that you've gone out and measured, you can compute something that we call the likelihood. It's the probability of obtaining the observed data given some value for the parameter. Let's call it theta. So the likelihood function is when you basically turn that likelihood number into a function, because after all, theta could have lots of different values. So you should really be computing theta for, or rather computing the likelihood for lots of different values of theta. So if you do that, what you get is like an infinite family of likelihood curves, which we call the likelihood function. All the principle of maximum likelihood says is that a good way to estimate theta is to take the one that maximizes the likelihood. So mathematically, you get it by taking dl by d theta equals 0, d2l by d theta squared less than 0. But what it means is that you choose the parameter to equal the value that makes the actual data that you did obtain the most likely out of all the possible random data sets that you could have obtained. So that's the guiding principle behind maximum likelihood. Now maybe that'll make a bit more sense if I show it in terms of a picture. I should mention just in passing that the likelihood function appears in the Bayesian probability theory definitions as well, because if you remember back in lecture one, we had Bayes' theorem when it was talking about Casio watches, and we had the likelihood, the prior, and the evidence on one side and the posterior on the other. So the likelihood function appears in both a frequentist and a Bayesian interpretation of probability. There's a subtle difference in the meaning and interpretation between the two cases, but we don't need to go into that here. Anyway, principle of maximum likelihood says a good estimator of theta is the one that maximizes L. So what does that really mean? Well, suppose you observe some value of X, so that's the red dot, and we want to use that observed value of X to try and infer an estimate of the parameter theta. And suppose that if the theta parameter is equal to this value, theta 1, the sampling distribution of X looks like the green curve as shown. Well, if that really were the case, if theta were theta 1, then X that we observed would be pretty unlikely, because it's far out into the tail of the distribution. Now, that doesn't mean that theta couldn't be theta 1, but it presumably means that the chances of theta being theta 1 are also quite small, because it would make the data that we observed quite unusual. What about if theta was equal to this value, theta 2? Well, maybe the sampling distribution, if theta equals theta 2, looks like this green curve. Actually, in that case, the observed value of X is even more unlikely, because although the mean of this distribution has moved a bit closer to X, the distribution is also narrower. So again, it doesn't mean that theta couldn't be theta 2, but it kind of suggests that that value of theta is somewhat unlikely. This is looking more promising. If theta was equal to this value, theta 3, then maybe in that case the sampling distribution would look like this green curve, in which case the observed value of X, well, it's not too far away from the maximum. So this is a reasonably probable value of X. What the principle of maximum likelihood says, as I said in words before, is just that if you observe a particular value of X, you take theta to be the value theta needs to be so that X appears at the maximum of that likelihood. It makes the value of X that you did observe the most likely out of all the possible values of X that you could have observed for that theta. I know it is a bit hard to get your head around. Unfortunately, in many situations, maximum likelihood estimators are just the same as least squares. And I think least squares estimators are a bit simpler intuitively to get your head around. So maybe this is a good thing. So let's see why that should be. Let's go back to the simple case we had at the start of lecture 3, which was a model where y was equal to a plus bx, and then there's some errors. So the ith residual epsilon I is assumed to be drawn from some underlying PDF. That's what I said in lecture 3, with mean zero invariance sigma I squared. But now let's assume that that PDF is Gaussian. And I'm going to write the likelihood as this. Now, I don't know if you'll have seen this notation before. It crops up in some areas of maths. A capital pi denotes a product. Capital sigma denotes a sum. Capital pi is a product. So I equals 1 to n. It's a product of n Gaussians. And I think I feel a pop quiz question coming on. How can we justify writing the likelihood as that product? Which of these four answers do you think is the explanation? Because the residuals are all equal to each other, because they're all Gaussian, because they're all positive, or because they're all independent. I hope that one's a wee bit easier. So by writing the likelihood as that product of Gaussians, and the reason we can do that is one of these answers, and hopefully you've got the right one. In fact, I only realised after I put the slides together last year that I'd actually told people the answer anyway on the next slide, and I thought, ah, well, it's not too long after Christmas, we'll just keep this in. So if you didn't get the previous question, the answer was D, because the reason you can write the likelihood as a product is because we're assuming the epsilon i's are all independent of each other. So if you think back to what we looked at in lecture 2, if you've got a multivariate distribution of several random variables, then if they're all independent of each other, you can write it as a product of their marginals. That means a product of just one-dimensional distributions. That's what we're doing here. Okay, so far so good. We've got ourselves a likelihood. It involves a product. That can be a bit messy algebraically. So what we do is we first of all substitute epsilon I equals yi minus a minus bxi. So we now see that the likelihood is a function of a and b. So what we want to do is to maximize that by finding dl by dA and dl by dB. But we've then got to differentiate a product rule and all that stuff. Perfectly doable, but a much easier way to do it, which is very, very common in this sort of field, is that what you do is you maximize the log of the likelihood, and that's often written as a curly L. It's given its own notation. Because if you maximize one, you automatically maximize the other, because there's a monotonic relationship between the log and the likelihood itself. So what that does is it turns the likelihood expression we had up here into this expression here. So you've got a bunch of constants that don't depend on A and B, minus a half times this sum that does depend on A and B, and that sum there is actually exactly the same as the expression S we had in the section on least squares. So if you want to maximize the likelihood, which is equivalent to maximizing the log likelihood, you do it by minimizing the sum of squares. So in the case where the errors are Gaussian and they're all independent of each other, then maximizing L is exactly equivalent to ordinary least squares. The maximum likelihood and the weighted least squares estimators are identical, so it doesn't actually matter whether they're weighted or not. That will just change whether or not there's a sigma I present here, or whether you can take it outside the sum, but the principle's the same. It will be that term S that appears in the log likelihood expression. Now, just to let you see that this sort of example does appear in real physics, well, actually, it's not so real physics as it looked 2 years ago, and I remember putting these slides in when we ran the course in 2012, that's right, and it wasn't too long after the OPERA experiment results, where it was beginning to look as if there might be something seriously wrong with relativity. And what I wanted to do was just to highlight that this analysis which, you know, to be fair to the authors, it was a very careful analysis. It was just that the media sort of got carried away with the story that this maybe meant neutrinos were going faster than the speed of light. And it was all to do with matching template spectra at CERN with what you see over here where they were arriving at the OPERA experiment. And this is straight from their paper, where what they're doing is they're working out the parameters by maximizing the likelihood function, which they approximate as a Gaussian, whose variance is a measure of the statistical uncertainty. And look, what they're plotting here is actually the log likelihood, which means it will look like a quadratic. So this is very, very common in the physics literature, that people will A, assume a Gaussian, and B, will actually work with the log likelihood rather than the likelihood itself. So that brings us on then to the next topic, because after all, if you're going to assume a Gaussian likelihood, you might want to have some way of checking that that's actually a good assumption. You know, you can't just say, well, the OPERA guys did it, so it must be okay. You want to have a stronger statistical basis for that assumption. And this is an example of a general idea in statistics called hypothesis testing. So you can be testing the model, the fact that you've got a Gaussian or a normal distribution. We'll focus a bit more on that tomorrow. Or you can say, well, yeah, I'm assuming I've got a Gaussian, but I don't know what the mean is. I don't know whether the mean is like, you know, 2 or 3 or minus a half or whatever value. So you want a way to estimate that parameter and then test the hypothesis that you've got a good fit to your data. How good is our PDF model in the first place? So we're going to start off by looking at a really simple example. I know I always say that, but you know, this one, hopefully you will agree, is fairly simple. It's where you've got some what we call null hypothesis that you want to test. Your sample data are drawn from a normal PDF with mean, mu, and variance sigma squared. You want to test that null hypothesis. Are your data consistent with it? So let's make it as simple as we can and assume that sigma squared is known. And suppose you measure 10 data points. Doesn't matter what they are, they can be from any field of physics you like. There's 10 of them, and they add up to 47.8. So under the null hypothesis, each one of those x values is drawn from a normal distribution with mean 4 and sigma squared also equal to 4, because we're assuming sigma is 2. So we want to test the hypothesis that the mean really is 4. Are those data consistent with that? Now, because there's 10, remember we talked about this morning, or no, it was just after lunch, been a long day already, that the sample mean, when you've got a sample of size n, has a smaller variance. So what we do is we take the variance of an individual x measurement, which is 2 squared, which is 4, and we divide that by 10, because it's a sample of 10 of them. So the sample mean should be normally distributed with mean 4 and variance 0.4. Okay? Now we got an observed sample mean of 4.78. We didn't get 4, but what's the big deal? You wouldn't surely expect to get exactly 4 every time. So what we want to do is to somehow characterize the difference between the 4 that we expected to get and the 4.78 that we did get, and then make a decision on whether those data are acceptable, or whether our model is acceptable for those data. So usually what we do is we transform to something we can work with more easily, which is called a standard normal variable. And that means a normal variable with mean 0 and standard deviation 1. So you've got your observed mean, which was our 4.78. You've got your model, we expect it to be 4. The standard deviation for the model is the square root of 0.4. because the variance was 0.4. So that variable z, which is the observed mean minus the model mean divided by the standard deviation, that should be normally distributed with mean 0 and standard deviation 1. Now what we found was that that variable had a value of 1.233. If the null hypothesis is true, then if we were to repeat our experiment a large number of times, we would expect that on average we'd get 0 and we'd get a standard deviation of 1. What we actually got from this one data set was 1.233. So what can we deduce from that about the validity of our null hypothesis? Well, what we do is we work out a number which is called the p-value. And it's a statement of how probable it is that you would obtain a value of z-obs as large as what you did, or indeed even larger. So just before we get on to calculating p-values, let's check you've got this thing about a standard normal variable. Suppose that x is sampled from a normal distribution with mean 5 and variance sigma squared equals 9. So which of those four is the corresponding standard normal variable? Just doing exactly what we did on the previous slide. So just to, again, give you a wee bit of a hint, if you look at the structure of what we did over here, just asking you to apply the same to construct the corresponding standard normal variable on this slide. Mean of 5, variance of 9. Okay? Right, back to p-values. In fact, it might be worth looking at the previous slide just before we do. The p-value is the probability of obtaining a value of z-obs as large as or larger than the one we actually did obtain. So how can we represent that graphically? Well, here, the red curve shows a standard normal distribution. And the value of z that we obtained was 1.233. So the probability of getting a value of z bigger than that is the area denoted by the right-hand yellow segment. It's the area under the normal curve to the right of 1.233. Or sometimes what we're also interested in is the probability of a negative value being less than what we obtained. So in other words, it's just the modulus that you work out. You want to know probability of the modulus of z being bigger than the modulus that you obtained, the absolute value. So that would be the sum of both yellow areas. And if you want to work it out, well, it's this integral expression as shown here. There are simple programs that do this sort of thing. Actually, I forgot to check if this web link was still working. Let me just do that now. I should have the internet. Yeah, that's fine. So this is a website called statpages.org. So, you know, the chances are, if you've got a package on your computer, it will have these functions built in. But if not, you can always find them on the web. And they're usually set up as like a Java applet. So you put in your value of z, and it will tell you what the probability of z being bigger than that is. And that's what we call the p-value. The smaller the p-value, the less credible the null hypothesis is. Because if you think about it, under the null hypothesis, if it's true, you're supposed to be sampling your actual data from this red curve. So if the sample you did obtain was way out in the wings, that would make it a very unlikely sample under that null hypothesis. The p-value just quantifies that. It captures that. Now you can also do a one-tailed hypothesis test. And in fact, the simplest one you could imagine is where under the null hypothesis, the test statistic isn't a normal curve like the red one we saw before, but is just a uniform distribution. Okay? And suppose you get an observed value of the test statistic, which was 0.8. So it's a uniform distribution between 0 and 1. So the p-value is asking you, what's the probability of getting 0.8 or bigger if the PDF is uniform between 0 and 1? So what would the p-value be in that case? What's the probability of getting 0.8 or bigger for a test statistic from a uniform distribution between 0 and 1? Hopefully that's one of the easier questions. The difficulty here isn't the calculation, it's keeping in your head a clear picture of what the things are actually defined as. And this is where the whole "there are lies, damn lies and statistics" really comes from, is the fact that there's a lot of jargon and terminology kicking around, and it's very hard sometimes to remember what it's all supposed to mean. Okay, what if you don't assume that sigma squared is known? Well, you can do something broadly similar. You can construct a statistic which is now the observed value of x bar, so that's, you know, your mean, your observed sample mean, minus the predicted sample mean, but now instead of dividing by sigma, because you don't know what that is, you divide by an estimate of it. And that estimate is given by this expression here, and the presence of the n minus 1 in the bottom, a bit like what I was saying earlier on, is to do with the fact that we don't know what mu is, the mean, we have to replace it by its sample estimate. That changes what we call the number of degrees of freedom, and means that you need a different term in the denominator. Again, if you have a suitable computer program to work all these things out for you, it will probably take care of all that for you. But now this t variable no longer has a normal distribution. It's got this student's t distribution that I mentioned before. But you can calculate the area in the wings of the student's t distribution, just like we could do the calculation for the area in the wings of the normal distribution. It's the same basic idea, and you get a p-value. And the smaller the p-value, the less credible the null hypothesis. So here's what the student's t-distribution looks like. There's a formula for it. It looks pretty horrible. But in terms of the picture, it's got a parameter. It's called the number of degrees of freedom, which I've already mentioned a couple of times. And the parameter nu is n minus 1, the number of degrees of freedom. And gamma nu, which appears in the normalization, is the gamma function that crops up a lot in things like thermal physics and physical mechanics. So if n is small, the student's t-distribution has got more extended tails. So if you look, if n is 2, that means nu is 1, and that would be the black curve that you see here. And then there's the dark blue one, then there's the green one going for 2, 5, then orange is 10, and if nu is infinity, then you just get a normal distribution. So the bigger the sample, the more it will look like a normal distribution, but the student's t is the right thing to use if you've got a small sample. Another pop quiz question, we're fairly rattling them up now. The more extended tails of the student's t distribution mean that, under the null hypothesis, larger values of the test statistic are more likely, larger values of the test statistic are less likely, smaller values of the test statistic are more likely, or smaller values of the test statistic are less likely. And a wee hint, it can be more than one of them, but it can't be all four. So there are two possible answers here, which are effectively equivalent. Again, if you look at the picture, the test statistic is t, t obs, and its distribution is one of these curves, depending on how many points there are in your sample. And the normal distribution is the pink one, so it drops off, and as you can see, the tail of the t distribution is always more extended. So the more extended tails of the student's t-distribution mean that under the null hypothesis, which of these four?
So can I ask to be clear, when you say smaller, do you mean more negative?
Well, in its absolute value. A smaller absolute value, that's the more precise way to say it. closer to zero, in other words. I know some of you have been doing it anyway, but by all means discuss it with those around you if you want. It's not essential that you do this on your own, far from it. Okay, can I maybe move on? Again, there'll be a chance to think about all of this at the end of tomorrow. I'll quickly run over all the questions if you want another few seconds to mull them over. Okay, so another aspect to hypothesis testing and decision theory I just want to introduce here. We've talked about testing a null hypothesis, but what if you've got an alternative you want to test it against? You know, you think it's either this theory's correct or that theory's correct, and you want to make up your mind which. So what the simplest such example of that would be where you've got one single null hypothesis that you want to test against a single alternative hypothesis. And the way you would go about that is you would define a kind of critical region, as it's called, a region within which if you get your test statistic to lie in that range, you would reject the null hypothesis and accept the alternative. Okay? So what we need to do is we need to consider the distribution of the test statistic under both the null hypothesis and the alternative hypothesis. It might look something like this. You measure some data. You've got a test statistic X, you're trying to estimate mu, the mean. And your null hypothesis is that mu is minus 2, and the alternative hypothesis is that mu is plus 2. Bit of an artificial example, but it's just to help illustrate what's going on. And in both cases, you assume you know what sigma is, and you assume that the sampling distribution is a normal distribution. So P of X given mu under the null hypothesis and the alternative hypothesis is as shown here. And suppose you choose the critical region to be X greater than 0. That means you go out, you measure your X, and if X is greater than 0, you say, the alternative hypothesis is true. If X is less than or equal to 0, then you say that the null hypothesis is true. So that's the setup. And by setting things up that way, as you can perhaps see from the shades that I've drawn in the diagram, the shaded regions, there are two ways in which you can make an incorrect decision. You can reject the null hypothesis when it's really true and you shouldn't have, or you can accept the null hypothesis when it's really false and you shouldn't have. We call these, respectively, a type 1 error and a type 2 error. And the probability of a type 1 error is the region shown by the vertical hash lines, because that's the region where X is greater than 0, but it's the area under the null hypothesis curve for X greater than 0. That's what chance there is that the null hypothesis is true, but X still winds up being greater than 0, so for this critical region you would reject it. And then conversely, the horizontal shading is the region where there's a probability that X is less than 0, so you would accept the null hypothesis, but it's really coming from the distribution under the alternative hypothesis. So again, you've made a boo-boo. You've rejected the alternative hypothesis, you've accepted the null hypothesis when you shouldn't have. So the consequences of that incorrect decision will be worse when the sampling distributions have a greater overlap. So if you look at the previous one, they didn't overlap very much, but over here there's a substantial overlap, and the probability of a type 2 error is now very large indeed. And that might well influence your choice of critical region. In other words, it might influence the point at which you start saying, no, I'm not going to believe the null hypothesis anymore. Because what you really want to do is to reduce the probability of both a type 1 and type 2 error. But you can't do both at the same time. Well, you can if you somehow devise a test statistic where they're as far apart as possible. But if you're stuck with your given test statistic and all you can do is vary the critical region, then by decreasing one type of error, you'll increase the other. There's a lot of terminology here as well, unfortunately, and I'm going through it fairly fast, but this is just to provide you with a reference bank that you can go back and refer to if you ever need to use this stuff. I know that at least some of you will, because, you know, this crops up in some research areas familiar to me. Another way to define a type 1 error is a false alarm or a false positive, or a type 2 error would be a false negative or indeed just a miss. Like sometimes type 1 error is also known as a hit. The sensitivity is the probability, or sometimes just the rate, of obtaining a true positive, a hit. And the specificity is the probability of obtaining a true negative. So again, there's relationships between all these different terms. And I don't want to get too bogged down in this because, you know, by this time tomorrow you've probably forgotten it all, but it's all there if you ever need to go back and use it. But in many fields, particularly in medical applications, including sort of a lot of medical physics applications, this idea of specificity and sensitivity is really important, and it's captured in a special type of graph called a receiver operating characteristic graph, or a ROC graph. And this is a plot where you plot false positive rate, which is equal to 1 minus the specificity, against true positive rate or sensitivity. And the blue dots would be the results for different hypothesis tests, maybe trialing different drugs, something like that. And of course, usually in medicine, what you want to do is cure as many people as possible while not killing too many in the process. So the balancing act between type 1 error and type 2 error can be really quite delicate. Fortunately, most of the time in physics, it doesn't really matter too much, except maybe it's embarrassing if you discover that paper you published turns out to be all nonsense, but at least nobody died. But ROC curves and things like this are used a great deal in medical applications because you really do have high stakes in terms of getting your hypothesis test right. So the blue dots are the results for different hypothesis tests. The red diagonal is just what you'd expect from a random guess alone, which, you know, clearly wouldn't be very good medical physics. You just kind of, like, you know, shut your eyes and pick a, the red pill or the blue pill at random. So clearly, what you want to do is to find yourself in the upper half of that diagram, the upper triangle. In fact, where you want to be is as close as you can to the top left corner. So how does this all work? Well, the thing is, even if you've got a particular hypothesis test, as we saw with the two Gaussian example, you can choose the critical region yourself. So you can adjust the position of the critical region, and what that would do is it would move you around in this diagram. So you can generate something called a ROC curve, receiver operating characteristic curve, which is for a given hypothesis test, you vary the critical region. So it can first of all help to optimize your choice of critical region for a given test, and indeed it can also help you to choose between different hypothesis tests. So let's look at how that might work. Remember, the goal is you want to be as close to the top left-hand corner as possible. So you can take the area under the ROC curve as a measure to compare different tests and choose which one is best. So this is from State University of New York, Albany Center for Excellence in Cancer Genomics. Don't ask me about the details of this. You know, I don't really understand all the details. But each one of these curves corresponds to a different hypothesis test for characterizing the genome of cancer patients. That's Freudian slip given the nature of the US health system, but there you go. So what you really want to do is you want to get this curve to be as close to the top left-hand corner as possible. So it would suggest, based on this rock curve, that this bottom one, no idea what PSSM-STR-SVM stands for, but that looks like the best discriminator, the best hypothesis test by which to characterize the genome of the patient. And for a given test, you can then vary the critical region, which what that does is it moves you along the rock curve, back and forth. In fact, there's a nice little applet for that. So here's our different regions, false positive, true positive, false negative, true negative. If you vary the critical region, it will effectively move that vertical line back and forth, and that will change the areas of the four coloured regions, which will change your position on the rock curve. So let's see if the applet works. Yep. So here's two normal distributions. There's the rock curve. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to drag the critical region boundary to the right. No, I'm not. Is it frozen up? Looks like it has. That's annoying. Let me try and reload it. Well, it's going to work now. So first of all, what I'm going to do, I think it will let me do both, but first of all, what I'm going to do is I'm going to drag the alternative hypothesis distribution to the right. Yeah, excellent. So now there's less of an overlap between the distributions, and the less of an overlap there is, the better the rock curve gets. It winds up being so good that really you're very, very close to that top left-hand corner. But you've still got the freedom to choose your critical region criterion, where you start rejecting the null hypothesis. And in fact, if you see, sorry it's so small, I couldn't make it any bigger, but as I move that criterion back and forth, you can see that the point is moving along the rock curve, and in fact, the point is closest to the top left-hand corner when it's exactly midway in between the two distributions. And the top master students have got to prove that as one of the problems on their example sheet. So if you fancy trying that, it's just basically a little bit of calculus. But you can see it by eye, and I guess it maybe kind of makes sense that you're minimizing the area that corresponds to a type 1 and a type 2 error. And you can achieve that most successfully when you're midway between the two distributions. But again, as we've noted, if the distributions are quite close together to begin with, then your ability to discriminate between the two hypotheses is severely limited. So you want to try and find test statistics that separate out the two distributions really well, which is really just common sense reduced to calculation. Okay, so we're nearly done for this session. This is a new section I've just recently put in. In all the previous versions of the EDA course, we didn't have this stuff in rock curves, but among the students who are going to be taking this as part of their top master's program are students doing a medical physics MSc. And this is so crucial for them that I wanted to put a few slides in. But there's other areas of physics where it crops up as well. In gravitational wave data analysis, we use these rock curves to try and determine optimal statistics to, well, ultimately we hope in the next few years to decide whether we've detected a gravitational wave or not. So although that might not be quite as life and death as medical physics applications, there's a lot at stake all the same. So there's a well-developed literature that we use to try and optimize our choice of hypothesis tests. I want to spend just the final bit sort of broadening out the scope a little bit into more general hypothesis testing, and in particular something called the chi-squared test. And for this I'm going to use an example from Phil Gregory's book, and because he's a radio astronomer, the example is an astronomy one, but again the details really don't matter, because you could use any sort of physics context to come up with a very similar example. There's your data. So it happens to be the flux density of a radial galaxy. Really doesn't matter what it is. But the key question is, does this galaxy have a constant flux density? These observations are taken at different times, and this is what you get. So the null hypothesis here, the model, is that the radial emission is constant in time. So what do you think? Do people think that looks as if it's constant in time? How many would say yes? How many would say no? How many aren't sure? Well, aren't sure is fine, because that's what we need the chi-squared test for. It's very rare you would get data that's so bleeding obvious that, you know, you can just tell by eye. You know, the PhDs to get those kind of data were all done decades ago. What happens is, by the time, you know, the next generation of PhD students comes along, you're sort of often digging around in areas where the noise is such that it's a bit harder to tell what's really going on. So how would we go about modelling this? Well, this is just straight from Phil Gregory's book. It's probably a bit hard to read on the screen, so I'm not just going to read it all. There's no point. You can go look it up for yourself. But I'm just going to tease out the key points. It's essentially setting down a kind of recipe for how you would construct the chi-squared statistic. So the idea is very similar to what we talked about in least squares, that you've got a set of observed values of xi, and you've got a mean value of xi. So under the null hypothesis, they're all supposed to have that value because it's supposed to be constant. And we're assuming here that sigma is known. So we want to evaluate that chi-squared statistic for our observed data. So that's what we do. And we assume that that chi-squared statistic, if our model is correct and the residuals are normal, should be drawn from something that we call a chi-squared distribution. And this is what chi-squared distributions look like. They have different degrees of freedom. The number of degrees of freedom, again, is related to the number of observations. So here's our data. Here's the flux densities. And the chi-squared that you get, the average is 7.98. The chi-squared that you get turns out to be 26.76. Now, there were 15 data points, but the number of degrees of freedom is only 14 because the chi-squared statistic should use the true mean, but we don't know what that is, so we've replaced it by its sample, and that reduces the number of degrees of freedom by 1. So if you go away and look up on a computer or on the internet what the chi-squared distribution with 14 degrees of freedom looks like, it looks like this. Looks like this curve. Now, we got a chi-squared value of 26.76. So just like we talked about before, you can calculate a p-value. It's the probability of getting 26.76 or greater if the null hypothesis is true. In other words, if these data really should have come from a chi-squared distribution. Now, that area doesn't look very big, so let's see if we can do a kind of rough estimate of it. So the mean and the variance of a chi-squared distribution with n degrees of freedom are n and 2n respectively. Remember, the variance is sigma squared. So in the Gregory example, there's 14 degrees of freedom, so n is 14. So okay, you could go look it up on a computer, but to calculate the p-value, really what you're trying to do is to get a handle on how many sigma away from the mean you are. So we got 26.76. The mean we expect is 14. 26.76 is quite a bit bigger. So how many sigma is that away from the mean? Remember, sigma squared is 2n. So is it between 0 and 1 sigma, 1 and 2 sigma, 2 and 3 sigma, or 3 and 4 sigma? You can't always just guess, of course, but it's possible to... This is just you getting a kind of ballpark figure using our knowledge of the mean and variance of the chi-square distribution. Okay? Now, if you're not very sure how to do that, not to worry. We'll go through the questions at the end of tomorrow, and this is one that I'll maybe take a few more seconds over by way of explaining how the calculation's done. But what you'd probably want to do in any case is do it more accurately. In other words, you would go to the internet or go to your favourite software package, and it would explicitly do that integral for you. It would work out what the area under that curve is up to the right of 26.76. And that is what we call the p-value. And it turns out to be about 0.02. So that's saying that there's only a 2% chance of getting a value as large as or larger than 26.76 if the null hypothesis is true. So Phil Gregory explains it in a bit more detail, emphasising that this is all very deeply connected to the notion of frequentist probability, where what you're doing is imagining that that sampling distribution is constructed by repeating the experiment a large number of times. Now, we might not do that. You might only do the experiment once. But the smaller the value of the p-value, the more likely it is, nonetheless, that the null hypothesis is not true. Now, how small is small? Well, it really depends. In fact, although you can calculate the chi-squared very precisely and objectively, your choice of whether or not to reject the hypothesis is really a subjective one. It's up to you. And frankly, it's more social science than physical science, because it might depend on whether you're trying to test your own theory or disprove somebody else's. And I don't say that flippantly, that's really true. If you've invested 30 years of your career in a particular model and some new data comes along, and you apply that data to your model and you get a p-value of 0.05, you might not be ready to give up on your model just yet. But if you've got a shiny new model that you think is the best thing since sliced bread and you get a p-value of 0.05, I bet you'll be writing a paper saying, this old model doesn't look right, why don't we try my model instead, because I get a p-value of 0.4 or 0.5 or something. It really will depend on what you've got invested in the model. If, on the other hand, the p-value is 0.00001 and you're looking for support for your model, don't expect a call from the Nobel Foundation anytime soon. So the smaller the p-value, the easier it gets to reject the model. What's difficult is when the p-value is hovering around the 2% or the 5%, which you can translate back into a sigma level. Think of the previous pop quiz question. So in some fields, like in particle physics, they look for a 5 sigma significance, which means the p-value corresponding to 5 standard deviations away from the mean, before they will accept that they found something. That was the standard of rigor applied to the Higgs results, for example. In social sciences, people publish papers with 2 sigma significance. You can judge for yourself which is more robust. Fortunately, in some cases, with big enough data sets, you can quickly arrive at still a very high level of significance, a high number of sigma. Say you take the example of the MMR vaccinations. Those studies have been done with such large samples that they're still very, very high significance, with the exception of the one that Andrew Wakefield did that only had, 14 patients or something. So his significance level was not high. Did the Daily Mail report that? Alas, not. But that's what you're up against. But all of that machinery allows you to make an objective decision to either feed or reject your subjective prejudice. And I'm afraid that's just the way it is. At least what it gives you is objective ammunition for either supporting your theory or rejecting someone else's. But use with caution. So here's a quote from Phil, which I think is kind of quite apposite. He says, "At this point, you may be asking yourself, why should we care about a probability involving results that you never actually obtained? Because this whole p-value notion is about repeatedly carrying out the observations and the number of times that those repeated observations would exceed the value that you actually got." In a way, this is the essence of the issues that people have with frequentist probability theory. But the bottom line is, if the p-value is small, then it's still going to be pretty hard to justify the null hypothesis and to wriggle out of the deduction that the null hypothesis is probably wrong. Just to let you see the kind of verbal gymnastics that people sometimes have to go through to be careful not to overstate what a significance means. This is some of the preliminary results from Atlas. So this is before they'd achieved the 5 sigma sensitivity in looking to detect the Higgs. So again, the physics details of this don't really matter, but this is like, you know, the energy scale of the Higgs-like particle that they were reporting at that time from the 2011 data. Here's what Sergio Bertolucci, the director, said: "I think that we may get indications that are not consistent with its non-existence." So, you know, he's not overstating it there. I say often the problem is that the scientists say it right, but the media reports just get it wrong. And that's where we can land ourselves in a great deal of trouble. So if you ever find yourself writing a press release about a big discovery, make absolutely sure that what goes into the newspaper is what you want to go into the newspaper, even if it means you've got to say things like this. Obviously, within a year, it got a lot better, and they were able to make more positive statements. But this was, you know, essentially saying that we don't think we've not detected something, which isn't quite the same as detecting something. So p-values are everywhere. All sorts of areas of physics, all sorts of areas of the physical sciences, and indeed well beyond, into medical science, into social science, and so on. There's a whole range of different tests. They all come down to calculating a p-value and then making a judgment based on how small the p-value is. I've put a whole bunch of supplementary notes on in my super and Moodle about some of these other tests, just in case they're of use to people. Moodle, by the way, is our local virtual learning environment, so that's only relevant for the MSc students who are going to be watching the videos of this later. So on my super, everyone who's here in the room can access them. And I just want to end this session before we break for a coffee break. I've overrun a couple of minutes, but a wee bit of light relief, but to set the scene for a Bayesian example we're going to look at in the final session. I want to emphasise that we can do hypothesis testing in a Bayesian framework, I think, in a more flexible way, because you can kind of update your hypothesis as you go along, as you get new data. So we're going to look at that. This is a slide we looked at back in this morning, where we had the posterior was proportional to the likelihood times the prior. And I said it was like, the prior is what you knew before, the likelihood is what the data tell you, and the posterior is what you know now. So what should you choose as the prior? Well, that really is a good question, and we'll see tomorrow that there are some very principled arguments using things like maximum entropy that you can employ to decide on your prior, but it is still the source of much debate between frequentists and Bayesians, because the frequentists say, well, your results are no good because they're too dependent on your choice of prior. So what I want to do is just show you a quick illustration of how, if your data are good enough, then it really won't matter. So that's what we're going to look at after the break. And before we do that, I want to show you a situation which is almost the exact opposite, where the data are so bad that your prior really dominates. So we want to be in a situation where the likelihood dominates. We want to be in a situation like this column, where the likelihood is nice and sharply peaked, the prior can be very broad, no information at all really, and the posterior will still be nicely sharply peaked. If, on the other hand, your prior is very sharply peaked and the likelihood is really broad, then all you'll get back is the prior assumptions that you started with. So we want to be in the left-hand situation, and we'll look at such an example after coffee. Just to to take us into coffee, I'm going to use an example from Simon Singh that I think you might find quite amusing. It's to do with the Hubble constant. Again, details don't matter, but many of you might know anyway. The Hubble constant measures the expansion rate of the universe. So Edwin Hubble, after whom the space telescope is named, back in the 1920s, basically had to fit a straight line to data, just like we were talking about earlier. These are his data. They're not really very good. And that is what Simon Singh was trying to illustrate in a public lecture, which he talks about in his book Big Bang, and I've got an extract from that public lecture that I'm just going to show you now.
I'm going to explain this in a rather unusual way, so just bear with me for a second, and hopefully it all makes sense. I'm going to play a little bit of Led Zeppelin. Here we go. So this is Stairway to Heaven. That's Stairway to Heaven by Led Zeppelin, a song I'm sure lots of you have heard lots of times before. What I'm now going to do is play that to you again, but this time I'm going to play it to you backwards. Okay? So about 15 seconds worth, and just have a listen to this and see what you make of it. Here we go. This is a crucial question. Hands up if you've heard the word Satan.
Feel free to join in.
Okay, that's a good couple of dozen if you heard the word Satan. That's great. Now hands up if you heard the word, here's to my sweet Satan. The one who's in the path who made me sad, whose power is Satan, oh he'll give you 666, there was a little tool shed where he made us suffer sad Satan. Hands up if you heard that. Just me. Right. Right. The extraordinary thing is this. I'm going to play this to you again, and this time you are all going to hear these words, okay? And I have to promise you two things. First of all, I am not going to cheat. This is going to be such a shock, so surprising, that you will assume that I've cheated or manipulated the sound or treated it in some way. What I'm going to play you is exactly what you just heard. Stairway to Heaven, just play backwards. I have to promise you I'm not cheating. Secondly, I promise you is you will hear all of these words, okay? So here we go, Stairway to Heaven, backwards, exactly the way you just heard it, but this time I think that you are all going to hear all of these words. Here we go. Now I find this extraordinary. I have to promise you again, I haven't cheated there. I just find it extraordinary. I play it to you the first time, and nobody hears anything really. Maybe the odd word Satan, but nothing really. And that's because there is nothing there. When you play a song backwards, it's gibberish. And first time around, that's pretty much what we all agree. But then I played it to you again, and the second time round, you all heard an entire coherent paragraph about Satan in a tool shed. So how did that work? Well, what changed was the second time I showed you some words. I suggested these words to you. I implanted them in the back of your mind. In fact, more than that, I compelled you to hear them. I said, I promise you, you'll hear these words. And so I've given you a bias, a prejudice, an expectation. And your brain is this lovely computer that loves to find patterns, that loves to find meaning. You've had so many conversations in noisy corridors or on bad telephone lines, or you've only partly heard what's said. So your brain has to make sense of that by filling in the gaps. And it does it all the time. And 99% of the time, your brain gets it right. But every so often, if you give the brain bad data, but you give it a big enough bias and a big enough expectation, your brain fills in the gaps, and you end up hearing something that really isn't there. It's only there because you kind of expect to hear it there. And that's all that happens. You heard something that wasn't there because you were kind of suggested to hear it. And that's the effect. It's incredibly powerful, but that's all it is. So what's this got to do with the Big Bang Theory? Well, scientists are only human too. And scientists have biases and expectations and prejudices. And so when scientists look at data, especially if it's bad data, and remember Hubble's data, Hubble was looking at the most distant objects then known, measuring tiny, tiny shifts in color. His data was up for interpretation. So people who didn't believe in the Big Bang, and remember, nearly everybody didn't believe in the Big Bang, would interpret Hubble's data to fulfill their expectation that it still didn't prove the Big Bang. Remember, all the professors didn't believe in the Big Bang, the establishment didn't believe in the Big Bang, the textbooks didn't believe in the Big Bang, Einstein didn't believe in the Big Bang. So people would look at the data and interpret it to fill that prejudice, so that they continued not to have to believe in the Big Bang.
So there you go, an example of where if you have prior dominated very bad data, then you wind up really just fulfilling your own prejudices there, if you can say it properly. So we'll pick up the threads after coffee. Let's start again at 4. I think that will still get us finished on schedule, about 10 to 5. Okay, thank you very much.